Welcome to the Jacksonville First Seventh-day Adventist Church podcast, where we listen, learn, and love together. Our speaker today is Pastor Jonathan Pinato.
One of the root ideas of Sabbath is that all living things, and many non-living things as well, they will thrive only by an ample measure of stillness and aloneness. A bird flying, never nesting, is soon plummeting. Grass trampled day after day scalps down to the hard bone of the earth. A saw used without relenting, its teeth never filed, its blade never cooled, will grow dull and brittle. An engine that is never shut off will gum with residue or fatigue from thinness of oil. That engine will sputter, it will blow a gasket, it will stall, it will cease. Even companionship languishes without seasons of apartness. You see, God stitched into the very nature of things an inviolable need to be left alone now and then. And I can hear all the men saying, Amen. Now, joking aside, one of the primary ways that people receive this aloneness and stillness is primarily through sleep. And hence, I've titled this presentation, Sabbath Sleep. And what we want to do is explore the concept of sleep in relationship to Sabbath. So now let's take some time to ponder about sleep. And I don't want you to fall asleep on me as we explore the concept of sleep. Now, talking about sleep, we can defy slumber only so long, propping ourselves upright with caffeine or manufacturing artificial alertness with the drugs, but past a certain point, we will collapse. We must submit to sleep's benign tyranny. Oh, yes, we must enter its inescapable vulnerability. You see, in sleep, we're by ourselves, even when enwrapped by another's arms. And unless we sleep, we will suffer great harm. Just Google the effects of sleep deprivation. And so once upon a time, there was a man by the name of Mark. And Mark ran himself so ragged once. He was working with only a couple hours of sleep for a number of weeks. I don't know how people can do that. I mean, I miss one good night of sleep, and then I'm no good for the next 2 or 3 days. But Mark was working on only a couple hours of sleep for a number of weeks. And finally, one day at the office, this tsunami of exhaustion just rolled over him. His eyelids were so heavy. He felt a weight above him. And so he just could not resist any longer. He could not hold himself up. He could not prop himself up. And he laid his head down on his desk and he crashed right there in his office in the middle of the workday. He fell into a sleep so deep that had God plucked a rib from his side, fashioned a woman from it, he wouldn't have so much as twitched. The office administrator afterwards told him that she had come by to ask him something, and she saw him dead asleep. And so she first checked to make sure he had a pulse and was breathing. And then once she made sure everything was okay, she called the other assistant, and they both stood there at the doorway looking at him and laughing at him. Mark was oblivious to the entire thing. Mark was in a land far, far away. His body had been pushed and bullied and cajoled and coerced long enough that finally it managed to stage a general strike, an all-out boycott. Mark had lost the power to resist, and so he fell victim to sleep. And so he slept. Now, what does this have to do with Sabbath? Well, Sabbath is a form of rest, unlike sleep. Sleep is so necessary, it is so needed, that defied too long, our bodies inevitably, even violently, force the issue. Sleep eventually waylays all fugitives. It will catch you, and it will have its way with you. But Sabbath won't do that. If the Sabbath is resisted, it will back off. Spurned, it will wait. It's easy to skirt or defy Sabbath. It's easy to manufacture cheap substitutes in its place. We already spoke about leisure time in a previous presentation in contrast to Sabbath time. It's easy to manufacture cheap substitutes in its place and to do all of this initially without noticeable damage and sometimes briefly even with admirable results. You see, it's easy, in other words, to spend most of your life breaking Sabbath and never figuring out that that's why part of the reason why our work is unsatisfying and our friendships are patchy and our leisure is threadbare and our vacations are exhausting, that part of the reason is because we are breaking Sabbath. We simply have not taken the time. We have not been still long enough, often enough, to know ourselves, to know our friends, to know our family, to know our God. Indeed, one of the worst hallucinations busyness conjures is the conviction that we are God. Indeed, one of the worst hallucinations that busyness conjures is the conviction that we are God. That all the things depend on me working and grinding and hustling. And how will the right things happen at the right time and in the right way if I'm not the one that's pushing and pulling and watching and doing and worrying and stressing and on top of it all? You see, Sabbath keeping requires two orientations. One is God word and the other is time word. And we spoke about the time word focus in our last presentation, about the difference between chronos time and kairos time, and how the Sabbath brings the two together into aionios time, eternity. But you can listen to that in a previous presentation. Sabbath keeping requires two orientations, a Godward orientation and a timeward orientation. To keep Sabbath well as both a day and an attitude, remember a Sabbath heart, we have to think clearly about God and freshly about time. And unless we trust God's sovereignty, we won't keep the Sabbath. And unless we receive time as abundance and gift and not as ration and burden, we'll never develop a capacity to savor Sabbath. And so what I want to do today is I want to focus on that second aspect, that is a Godward orientation of the Sabbath. And so we read in Leviticus chapter 23 and verse 32. It says here, "From evening to evening, you shall celebrate your Sabbath." From evening to evening. Sabbath begins in the evening. We not only know that from Genesis chapter 1, but we also have a clear description here in Leviticus chapter 23. Sabbath begins in the evening. It begins, in other words, with rest and with sleep. Sleep is a necessity. But sleep is also a relinquishment. Sleep is self-abandonment. Sleep is abandonment of control. It is abandonment of power. Sleep is abandonment of consciousness. We direct nothing in our sleep. We control nothing in our sleep. We lose ourselves and we are carried away like children or like prisoners into a netherworld, alternately grotesque or idyllic. Carnivalesque or Elysian. In sleep, we become infants again, utterly vulnerable, completely defenseless, totally dependent. Bill was a hard-fisted, burly bear of a man. He could snap your bones like sticks with his bare hands. I mean, just look at those arms. Look at those guns that he has. Well, one night, Bill's house was burglarized. However, Bill was dead asleep. He was asleep a mere arm's length from the prowler. Bill knew nothing of the burglary until the following morning. He woke up to a terrible, terrible surprise. His girth and his brawn and all his strength and everything that he had did him no good. He was useless while he slept. And so, my friends, sleep, besides being a necessity, is also an act of faith. And what we're going to find out is that Sabbath, like sleep, is not only a necessity, but it too is an act of faith. It is Sabbath that will lead us toward a Godward orientation. And what do I mean by a Godward orientation? Notice what Psalm chapter 3, verses 1 and 5 says. O Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? But then the psalmist declares, but nevertheless, I lay down and I sleep and I wake again because the Lord sustains me. You see that trust there about sleep and David and having faith and trust and confidence in God while he sleeps. Psalm 4, verse 8, I will lie down and sleep in peace for you alone, O Lord. Make me dwell in safety. I don't know how many of you have memorized this one. My parents had us memorize this when we were children in Spanish. En paz me acostaré y así mismo dormiré, porque solo tú, oh Jehová, me harás estar confiado. I will lie down and sleep in peace, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. You see, every time we sleep, we place ourselves again in this position of vulnerability, of defenselessness, of dependency. We enter again this infant-like unguardedness. And we will do this well only under one of two conditions. Either utter exhaustion, where we can't help ourselves, like Bill or like Mark, or we will do so under complete confidence, where we've stopped trying to help ourselves. When we sleep well, it is because we know from whence our help comes. In contrast, sleepless nights, I don't know how many of you have had sleepless nights. Sleepless nights are when you wake up in the middle of the night without being able to go back to sleep because our minds can't stop thinking. I don't know how many of you have been there. I've been there. I can't go to sleep because the mind doesn't stop processing, or I wake up in the middle of the night unable at 2 a.m. in the morning, unable to go back to sleep because of the responsibilities that we bear, because of the burdens that we carry, because of the looming deadlines, because of the stresses that are overwhelming, because of the conflict that seems to have no resolution. But when we sleep well, it's because we know in whom we have believed, and we are confident that he is able to keep that which we have entrusted to him. We give ourselves, regardless of our unfinished business, we give ourselves into God's care. We can sleep well because we believe God will look after us. And it's the same with Sabbath rest. Real Sabbath, the kind that fills and restores us, depends on complete confidence and trust in God. Confidence and trust that is rooted in a deep conviction that God is good and God is sovereign. And here's where I'm speaking about a Godward orientation. For you see, there's no rest for those who don't believe that. If God works all things together for good for those who love him and who are called according to his purpose, Romans chapter 8, then we can relax and we can rest, knowing that he holds the whole world in his hands. He holds you and me, sister, in his hands. He holds all of us in his hands. He holds the future in his hands. If we know that, we can relax and we can rest. But if he doesn't, I'm telling you right now, if he doesn't, then you better start worrying. But if God can take any mess, any mishap, any wastage, any wreckage, anything, and weave beauty and meaning from it. And we saw this passage in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 11 where it says, and he has made all things beautiful in its time. He's a God who can work all things together for good. Even the bad things, even the terrible things, even the horrible things. He can work all things together for good. And if you believe that, if you trust it, if you believe that this is a God that can take all of it and weave beauty and meaning from it, then you can take at least one day off. But if God can't, then you better get busy. Either God's always at work watching the city, or you need to try harder. Either God is good and in control, or it all depends on you. And when we speak about having this kind of depth of trust, I think that King David is a good model for us. David trusted in God's goodness and in God's sovereignty. David had a life that was God-word orientated. In fact, the Bible tells us that he was a man after God's own heart. And we've already read about this, his depth of trust and confidence in God in Psalm 3 and in Psalm 4. But why don't we read Psalm 62? In Psalm 62, you may not know it at the beginning and you may not be able to tell while reading it, but Psalm 62 has historically been understood as a Sabbath psalm. Psalm 62, David's trust in God's goodness and sovereignty will be laced throughout his journal. And when I mean his journal, not just Psalm 62, but the entire of the Psalms that he wrote. In Psalm 62, verses 1 and 2, it says, "My soul finds rest in God alone." Now, some translations say, "My soul silently waits in God alone." That's actually the literal of the Hebrew is silently waits in God alone. But the idea that the Hebrew is trying to convey there is that my soul finds rest. I'm silently waiting because I am at rest. In contrast to those who are running to and fro who have no rest, no, my soul finds rest. Therefore, it can silently wait in God alone. My salvation comes from him. He alone is my rock and my salvation. God is my fortress and I will never be shaken. You see, what David is doing here is that David is training himself. And watch out with that word there because we're going to come back to it several times here. What David is doing here is David is training himself. And whoever else will listen, he is training himself to trust in God's goodness and in God's sovereignty. And this for David is no mere intellectual exercise. This is a way of survival for him. And it's the shape of David's life in the holy wild. What is the holy wild? The holy wild are those times when you find yourself in those dry and barren places of the soul. Seemingly in exile like David, David had to flee into the wilderness. For I don't know for how many years he was fleeing like an exile, like a fugitive from place to place before God's promises were fulfilled in his life. The holy wild are those times when you find yourself in those dry and barren places of the soul, seemingly in exile, in a weary and barren wasteland, where it appears that God does not hear or answer your prayers, or your prayers are delayed. Where it seems to be one calamity after another, one storm after another, one challenge after another, one conflict after another, one hardship after another, where there is no rest for the weary. It's those moments in your life when the sky above your head is bronze and the earth beneath your feet is iron. And what's happening to David here is that he is being beset by his enemies. He's being beset all around by challenges, by problems, by difficulties that are all bent on his ruin, seeking his destruction. And notice how he describes these things in verse 3 and 4. Notice how he describes his circumstances. He says, "How long will you assault me? Would all of you throw me down this leaning wall to batter this tottering fence?" He's describing himself as a leaning wall about ready to fall, as a tottering fence just ready to be knocked over, knocked down. "Surely they intend to topple me. They take delight in lies. With their mouths they bless, but in their hearts they curse." Have any of you ever been in a situation like this where you feel that you're at your wit's end, that you won't be able to make it, that you're about to topple over, that you're being battered left and right, that people are coming to you saying one thing and then behind your back they're saying something else? How do you survive in a world like this? How can you find rest in a world like this? Is it even possible to find rest in circumstances like this in a world of deceit and enmity? Well, David tells us that there is a way to be able to rest, but only one way to rest, and that is to find rest in God alone. You see, David had no way to dredge up rest from his circumstances. In fact, when he looks at his circumstances, they are quite discouraging. And I sometimes think that circumstances give us a false sense of hope and security. What I mean by that is that if our circumstances are favorable, if our circumstances are prosperous, then we feel safe and we feel secure. But if something happens to destroy the circumstances, where our circumstances now become unfavorable, then all our sense of security, our anchor is let loose and we don't know what we're going to do. And I think that what's happening now with this pandemic in the year 2020 and what's happening with the economy, even though it looks like it's going up, but we never know. That's the thing. We never know about these kinds of things. It goes up, it goes down. Joblessness and people out of work and unemployment not there anymore and the market shrinking and the market resetting itself and all these uncertainties that are taking place. I think that what God is doing is he's allowing our circumstances to be shapen so that we, like David, can find rest, not in our circumstances, not in our prosperity, but in him and in him alone. For David, his rest had to be sought elsewhere besides his circumstances, beside his prosperity. For David, his rest had to come from God and from God alone. David had to know God as his rock. David had to know God as his salvation. David had to know God as his unshakable fortress. David had to know God, that God alone is sovereign and that God alone works all things together for good for those who love him and who are called according to his purposes. But notice something here, because it will help us to train ourselves in like faith and trust as David did. You see, David begins Psalm 62 with a declaration. That is, he begins it with a confident assertion that his soul finds rest in God alone. Psalm 62, verse 1, my soul finds rest in God alone. My salvation comes from him. Declaration, confident assertion. But then after describing his circumstances, David's tone shifts a little bit. I wonder if, as he's looking at his circumstances, if his faith doesn't wane, if he doesn't get a bit discouraged. He does mention that he's this tottering fence, this leaning wall. And what he will do in verse 5 and 6 is that he will virtually repeat verbatim what he says in verse 1 and 2, except there's a slight difference. See if you can catch it. Verse 1 says, my soul finds rest in God alone. Verse 5 says, find rest, O my soul, in God alone. Did you catch the nuance? Did you catch the subtlety? Did you catch the shift there in the tone? And perhaps in the English, it's not all that apparent, but it's there in the Hebrew, in the grammar of the Hebrew. In verse 5 and 6, he says, find rest, O my soul, in God alone, for my hope comes from him. He alone is my rock and my salvation. He is my fortress. I will not be shaken. You see, what David is doing here is he is moving from declaration to imperative. In verse 1, declaration. In verse 5, it is imperative. In verse 1, it's declaration. My soul finds rest in God alone. But in verse 5, he is exhorting himself. He is commanding himself. He is willing himself. He's telling himself, find rest, O my soul, in God alone. David moves from saying how it is to how it ought to be in verse 5. He moves from celebration in verse 1 to exhortation in verse 5. He moves from a memoir of experience in verse 1 to a manual of instruction in verse 5. And the truth is, isn't that how it is for us? Or isn't that how it should be for us? And so we find ourselves sometimes saying, I'm doing this, I'm resting, I'm at peace, I've paused, and then something happens in our circumstances and then we're like, wait a minute here, well, maybe I don't got this, wait a minute, I'm overwhelmed, this is overwhelming, no, but then, no, but I can do this, no, I've got to do this, no, I can do this, oh, I'm doing this, I am doing this. You see, this really becomes a discipline and a training for us. It's a way of thinking which leads to a way of living, which leads to a way of behaving, the essence of a Sabbath heart. Because what's the alternative for us here? When we're beset all around with difficulty and trouble, what is the alternative for us? When we look at our circumstances and we find ourselves being a tottering wall or a leaning wall, a leaning fence, what's the alternative for us? What should we say? I can't do this. There's no rest. There's no rest in God. It's all hopeless. No, it's no use. I'm wasting my time. I give up. Yep, I give up. I'm done. I quit. No, I'm out. This doesn't work. Come on. What's the alternative when we find ourselves in circumstances that are unfavorable? Give in to despair, to quit? No, never. And so what David is doing here is he's training us and he's teaching us how he trained himself in confidence and hope from declaration to imperative. And so we likewise train ourselves to find rest in God. But then in moments when our faith is wavering and waning, we then exhort ourselves to find rest, to find hope, to hold on, to say, He is my rock. God is my salvation. God is my hope. God is my fortress. I will never be moved. I will never be shaken. In C.S. Lewis's classic work, Prince Caspian of the Chronicles of Narnia, there's a scene where the children haven't seen Aslan the lion in a long time. And Lucy especially wants to see him. And when she finally sees him, she says, Oh, Aslan, you're bigger than what I remember. And Aslan responds to Lucy and he says, No, I'm not. I'm actually the same size I was when you last saw me. But it's because you've grown, Lucy, and are older that I appear bigger. And Lucy's like, wait a minute, what? That doesn't make sense. You're telling me that you're the same size you were last time I saw you, even though you appear to me bigger than you are, and you tell me that the reason that you appear bigger is because I've grown and become older? And Aslan says, yes. Every year you grow, you'll find me bigger. And I think that that's a beautiful illustration for how it is for those of us who train ourselves in God's goodness and in His sovereignty. For those of us who are intentional about orientating our lives Godward. Every year that we grow in faith, we will find God bigger than all our circumstances, bigger than all our problems, bigger than anything. But we have to have faith and confidence in Him. We have to trust Him, and we have to put Him to the test. And we have to step out in faith. And what does that mean? What does that look like for you? What has God been convicting you about? What are those things that He's asking you to believe and to trust Him and to have confidence in Him and to step out in faith? We speak about tithe and offerings, and I think that's a powerful thing, to be faithful in tithe and offerings. That's really, I think, where the rubber hits the road here. Can I trust God by giving Him this portion of my income? Is He big enough to provide for Him? Can I trust Him, especially now during an economic downturn where means are scarce and where they're unreliable and I should probably start saving as much money as I possibly can? Can I trust God that if I'm still faithful in my tithe and offerings, that He will take care of me, that He will provide for all my needs? It's an act of faith to step out and believe God and believe God's word. Can I trust Him coming back to the Sabbath? Can I trust them with the Sabbath, even though at work they're asking me to go into work, and right now job security is scarce, and what if I don't go into work on Sabbath and they fire me? Can I trust God that if I keep the Sabbath, He will continue to provide for me? How about an act of faith of coming to church, that I trust God and I will come to church and I'll come to church faithfully and I will involve myself in the life of the church? What about those things that He's convicting you about in your personal life or in your family devotion or in your personal devotion or sharing with others about the gospel or whatever it is that He's asking you to do? In your relationships, at your work, in your family, in your marriage, in your children, if you take His word as it reads and you put it into practice, can you trust Him to work it all out? Because what you're going to find is that in the end, obedience is an act of faith and trust. Obedience is an act of faith. And so what I want you to do is I want you to practice the presence of God until you are utterly convinced of his goodness and of his sovereignty. I want you today to make the decision saying, God, I want to orientate my life God-ward until you are bigger than all my problems and than all my circumstances, until I can find rest in you and you alone. I want you to practice the presence of God. How can you do that? Well, one of the first ways you can do that is by practicing thankfulness, about allowing your heart to be drawn out to God in thankfulness. As you pray and as you commune with God, don't put your problems first. How about you start with God and with all the good things that he has done for you? How about you make a list? Yes, take out a piece of paper and a pen. And why don't you make a list of all that God has done for you? And how about you recite it, all the blessings, all the ways that he's come through for you? How about you recite them and you proclaim it and you believe it and you breathe it? How about we practice the presence of God until we are utterly convinced of his goodness and of his sovereignty? How about this morning we make the decision, we say, God, I want my life to be orientated in your direction. I want a Godward orientation.
This podcast is brought to you by the Jacksonville First Seventh-day Adventist Church. Connect with us on www.jaxsda.org or on Facebook and YouTube. We look forward to sharing more inspiring messages with you.